Jeffrey, let's just start out by having you briefly explain why it is that you compiled this book, Perilous Times, Free Speech in Wartime.
Well, I started working on it after 9/11, and this is material that I had taught for many years, and I was aware of the fact that no one had written anything systematic on this subject for well over half a century. And it seemed to me that given the circumstances of the times, it was a particularly apt moment in which to review our history and to see what lessons we might be able to learn from it.
Now, we're talking pretty specifically here, free speech, not so much the other parts of the First Amendment, issues related to peaceable assembly and freedom of religion, freedom of press.
Actually, freedom of press and freedom of assembly are certainly amalgamated into the idea of free speech, but religion is not something that I touch on except very incidentally.
Now, you note very early on that the Constitution limits only the ability of Congress to abridge speech, and not any individual states, any municipalities, any private entities. Why is that an important point?
Well, the original Bill of Rights, when it was enacted before the turn of the 19th century, was designed, as was the basic Constitution, as a set of rules about the federal government. And the initial guarantees in the Bill of Rights of speech and press and assembly and religion and due process and prohibition on cruel and unusual punishment and all of those were simply restrictions on the federal government, on the national government. And so states were perfectly free, insofar as the U.S. Constitution was concerned, to do all those types of things, to regulate all those types of activities without raising any federal constitutional issue. Now, each state has its own constitution, and those constitutions might play a similar role or not in each individual state. It was after the Civil War when the whole notion of the nation was reconceptualized that Congress adopted the 14th Amendment, which provided that no state shall deny any person equal protection of the laws, life, liberty, or property without due process of law, or the privileges or immunities of citizenship. And in the 75 years after that, the court gradually came to the view that the rights guaranteed in the original Bill of Rights against the federal government were made applicable to the states and to all of the various units of the states, meaning cities and universities, public universities, and the like, through the 14th Amendment. So that when somebody says that a law in the state of Illinois violates the First Amendment, what they really mean is that it violates the 14th Amendment, which incorporates the guarantee of the First Amendment against the state of Illinois. So the notion that the 14th Amendment profoundly altered the constitutional structure of the nation is demonstrated by the fact that until really 1927, the Supreme Court had not recognized that any state law could violate the freedom of speech or the freedom of religion or their freedom from unreasonable searches and seizures. All of those were thought to be not matters of federal constitutionalism.
Now, you list early on three key issues or principles, as you say, that are crucial to understand in the conversation related to free speech in wartime. They are no government paternalism in the realm of political discourse, punish the actor, not the speaker, and the idea of low-value speech. And let's go through each of these briefly, one at a time, and just to set context for the rest of the conversation. So the issue of no government paternalism in the realm of political discourse, how would you describe that?
Well, a key principle of self-governance is that it is for the people themselves to make up their own minds about matters of public policy, and that the government, therefore, may not rule out of bounds, may not censor an idea because the government has decided that that is a bad idea. The people are always free to consider any idea, however loathsome or odious it might seem at the moment to other citizens, even a majority of the other citizens. And it's the ability of Americans to continue to deliberate about questions that enables change and growth and an evolving society. And that's a central principle of the First Amendment, and it's pretty much an absolute rule. The government may never punish a speaker because she has espoused ideas that the government thinks are bad or false ideas.
Let's skip over to punishing the actor, not the speaker.
Right. Well, another problem that often recurs in conflicts over free speech is that an individual, let's say, gives a speech criticizing the war in Iraq. And for the reason we just established, the government may not prohibit that person from making the speech because the government has concluded that the war in Iraq is a good thing and that the speaker's ideas are therefore not worthy of being heard by other citizens. That argument would be out of bounds. On the other hand, the government might argue that if an individual criticizes the war in Iraq, that will have the tendency to turn Americans, or at least some of them, against the war. And if that happens, then individuals may refuse, for example, to go and serve in Iraq when they're ordered to do so. And the government has a legitimate interest in ensuring that soldiers obey orders. So the government might say that we want to prohibit people from criticizing the war in Iraq, not because we think that criticism is necessarily a bad idea, which the government can't do, but rather because we fear that if someone is allowed to criticize the war, it will lead to the consequence of some soldiers refusing to fight in Iraq. That's an unlawful act, and we should not tolerate speech that causes other people to engage in unlawful acts. And in that situation, the presumption that you punish the actor rather than the speaker essentially says that it is permissible to punish the soldier who refuses to go to Iraq, but it's not permissible to punish the speaker for giving a speech criticizing the war on the premise that the existence of that speech makes it more likely that soldiers will refuse induction or refuse to report. And the reason for that, of course, is that if you give the government the power to punish speech merely because it has the potential to cause other people to do bad things, then essentially you enable the government to prohibit speech that it doesn't like on the pretext that its real concern is that the speech causes other people to do bad things.
Let's touch on the last one, the idea of low-value speech.
Well, the two principles that we've talked about already are generally applicable to the regulation of speech under the First Amendment, but the Supreme Court has recognized over the years that there are certain types of expression that are not within the core of the freedom of speech that the First Amendment was intended to protect, and that those categories of speech may be regulated more readily by the government. A good example would be false statements of fact. So suppose an individual makes a false statement of fact defaming you, stating that you committed a crime, and it's a false statement, and the person knows it's a false statement. In that situation, the law will allow the person who engages in the defamation to be punished for making that knowingly false statement of fact, not because the defamation you suffer is of such profound importance that we need to set aside the basic assumptions of the First Amendment, but because we think that a false statement of fact knowingly made is not a contribution to public debate, and therefore it can be regulated in a more flexible way. And the court has made similar judgments about a list of categories such as threats, express incitement to violence, obscenity, commercial advertising. Now, those are all examples of speech where the court has said that those types of expression do not so centrally support the values underlying the First Amendment that they need to be subject to the first two principles.
Now that we've got a little bit of a conceptual framework, let's dive into what's actually the main body of perilous times. So first, let's talk about the first blow against the First Amendment taking place not even a decade after the First Amendment was finally adopted and ratified as the Constitution, the Alien and Sedition Acts of 1798. I guess we should more focus on the Sedition Act because it's more prominently featured than the Alien Act. Tell us just briefly what the Sedition Act of 1798 said and why the government felt as though it needed to adopt it.
Well, the act made it a crime for any person to make any public statement that cast contempt upon the president, the Congress, or the government of the United States and would tend to bring them into disrepute. And the rationale of the legislation at the time was that the United States was thought to be on the verge of a possible war with France. The Federalists, who then controlled the national government, John Adams being president, and the Federalists had the control over both the House and Senate and all of the judiciary, essentially took the view that if the nation was going to fight a war successfully and effectively, it needed for the American people to hold the government in high esteem, to trust them, to regard them positively, and to be willing to follow them so the nation could fight a war well. And that criticism of the government, the president, the Congress, during such a time would undermine the ability of the nation to defend itself, and therefore that speech that cast contempt upon the president of the Congress could be prohibited. The real reason for the legislation, or an ulterior additional reason for the legislation at the time, was that the Federalists and the Jeffersonian Republicans were very much at odds during this period. Adams had defeated Jefferson by only 3 electoral votes in 1796. The two parties were extremely polarized, and the Federalists were worried about the election of 1800 and the possibility that Jefferson and his Republicans would defeat Adams and the Federalists. And so the Sedition Act was additionally a way to diffuse the Republican press. And indeed, the act itself, once it was enacted on a straight party line vote by the Federalists and opposed by the Republicans, was used exclusively against members of Jefferson's party, including a sitting congressman and every major Republican editor in the country, in an effort to secure victory for the Federalists in the 1800 presidential election.
You are listening to Jeffrey Stone, author of Perilous Times, Free Speech in Wartime, From the Sedition Act of 1798 to the War on Terrorism. We'll be back with him in just one moment.